Hi, welcome to Indiana Weekend with John Strauss. This is a kind of radio magazine show about the interesting places and intriguing people in our part of the state. We're always interested in your thoughts. Drop us a note at indianaweekend@gmail.com with your suggestions and comments. Let us know what's going on where you are. In this bicentennial year, Indiana is celebrating all things Hoosier. Now, a new book by a Bloomington writer collects some of the state's best stories. Doug Wissing is the author of this collection of stories and essays. We talked outside on the terrace at the Indiana Historical Society on the downtown canal in Indy, the conversation sometimes punctuated by sirens from the nearby firehouse. The book is called In, as in Indiana, Writing, Uncovering the Unexpected Hoosier State.
These were all published before, from publications like the New York Times and Los Angeles Times to the Indianapolis Star, Indianapolis Monthly, Nouveau, Traces. These pieces about Indiana came from everywhere, and we collected them all together, we being Indiana University Press and Indiana Historical Society Press, who co-published the book, and it is sort of an alternative history of Indiana as we're in our bicentennial year. It's this pixelated view of who we are. It's us in our uniqueness, and it's us in our universality. I think the part that has always interested me is our connections to the wider world, often very counterintuitive connections to the wider world. For instance, Indianapolis has a connection to Tibet, a strong connection to Tibet, that goes back more than a century. And at one point early in the 20th century, the only place that you could learn to speak Tibetan was Indianapolis. And people go, what?
So Indiana isn't just a subject for you. This is home going back generations.
This is home going back generations. I grew up in Vincennes, which is, of course, the state's oldest town where my family had settled in the 18th century. They were French fur traders that had come down from Quebec. And we've been there ever since. My father's family, he was an Alsatian French Foreign Legionnaire who came to Vincennes to start, what else, a brewery. That goes back to the 1850s, and we're rooted here.
Among the people from Vincennes, Red Skelton.
Yeah, my grandfather was heavily involved with show business from the time he was a young man. He was a vaudevillian. He ran an enormous vaudeville theater. He was an impresario. He was a composer. So if you think about Cole Porter and Hoagie Carmichael, that Tin Pan Alley era of American music, my grandfather was part of that. And when he was managing a large vaudeville theater there, the Pantheon, Red Skelton was a kid growing up, a penniless kid growing up. And so my grandfather kind of adopted him, and he ate a lot with my mother and, you know, with the kids. And he was just a natural ham. He was a natural show business guy. And my grandfather finally told him, you need to get out of town, Red. You got too much talent. So he joined a medicine show. So we're talking about a man who goes from medicine shows and working on showboats up and down the rivers to being a star of cinema, radio, and television. He encapsulated an enormous part of American music.
So your family knew Red Skelton. Did they ever see him when you were a child?
Oh, yeah. When Red Skelton would come to town, it was a big deal. And one of his first stops was always my grandfather's house, where they would disappear into the office and they would close the pocket doors and they would reminisce about the old days. And my grandfather knew all those guys, you know, Cab Calloway. He collaborated with the father of the blues, W.C. Handy. He was part of American entertainment. And he was a great mentor for Red. I actually met Red when he was in his 70s. He was donating a book to the Lilly Rare Book Library at IU, and he stopped everything when I said my grandfather was Clarence Stout Sr., and we had a wonderful conversation as he reminisced about how important my grandfather was. So he always stayed rooted in Vincennes.
I wonder if you can read just a little bit from your book, and I love this essay, The Song of Indiana. Read to us a little bit from that, if you could.
Sure. I have driven from one end of this great state to the other, zigzagging across the dimples and folds and flatlands of Indiana, winding down countless country lanes. And I can testify there is a lot of Indiana to experience. The glint of the dawn on the Ohio River, the powder sugar hills of the dunes, canal boats, vintage cars, and old-time trains, fireflies dotting a summer field into a pointless canvas, and forests ablaze with autumn colors stretching to the horizon, the smell of new hay, old wine, and campfires flickering on a cool evening. Ah, Indiana, here's to your rivers and roads and endless prairies, to your expansive forests and deep lakes, to your layers of history and the energy of your many cultures, and especially to your people, who twang out their greetings and take the time to tell you how to get there.
Doug Wissing, the Bloomington author whose new book, In Writing, Uncovering the Unexpected Hoosier State, is out now. He writes about the courageous farmer soldiers of the Indiana National Guard who go to Afghanistan to win hearts and minds through agriculture, Columbus and its remarkable architecture, Bloomington's Tibetan community, New Harmony and its enduring idealism, the Calumet region, Crown Hill Cemetery, and other landmarks. The book is from Indiana University Press and the Indiana Historical Society.
Indiana Weekend.
Interesting people and places from across our region.
Look for that name on Facebook and drop us a line.
Let us know what you think at
indianaweekend@gmail.com.
I'm Doug Wissing. I'm a journalist and an author. I've published with a broad range of people from the New York Times and LA Times and Washington Post, CNN and National Geographic Traveler to regional publications. I've written 10 books, and my latest one is called In Writing, Uncovering the Unexpected Hoosier State.
Why unexpected?
Well, there's a certain dismissiveness that people from outside the state have about Indiana. And when I tell them stories of Indiana, there's always like, what? I didn't know that.
Every state wants to take pride that it is somehow unique and different. Could you have done this book in Ohio or Illinois or Michigan?
I have reported in a lot of places around the world, and I always feel like the key to success is to find somebody who is part of that culture but is a little akimbo to it, and so they can explain it to me. And I always feel like I'm looking for someone who can tell me what is the poetry of that place, what makes it unique, and there's also what is the commonality, you know, the brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles that is the universal key to understanding. So I guess I was making an effort to tell the poetry of Indiana. What are the little quirks and the great surging exceptional parts of us?
You know, there are places in this state that a lot of people who live here have not been, and I would venture to say New Harmony, for example. Really fascinating place, fascinating history. You did an essay from there. Talk about that a little bit. Did you get a special feeling as you were, because it's a spiritual kind of place.
If folks haven't been to New Harmony, they really should do this. It is a magical place, and it is this place that two totally different utopian groups came to when Indiana was still essentially a wilderness, and they were both trying to find heaven on earth in completely different ways. And the town has always attracted dreamers and idealists, and some of the great social movements of our day, from the labor movement to kindergartens to the geologic study of America, all go back to this really tiny town on the Wabash. And it remains a very inspirational place. I really do encourage people to go there.
Were there stories here that were fun to work on because maybe you weren't expecting to find what you did discover?
Yeah, I'm thinking of the Ezra Pound story. Ezra Pound at Wabash College. And if for you literary people out there, everybody knows Ezra Pound was the founder of modernist poetry and was essentially a wild man. And I was reading a book, actually had plucked a book off the shelf at my local library. I don't even remember why. It fell open to a page and I read, when Ezra Pound was a faculty member at Wabash College, blah, blah, blah. And something that did not fit together. It really, because as we know, Wabash College is a pretty straight-laced place. And Ezra Pound, who was indicted for treason after World War II, spent most of the next decades in a mental institution. This didn't fit. He's the man that edited The Wasteland. He really was a guiding light of modernist literature. He didn't fit at Wabash College at all. And I must have read that 10 years before I finally had time to go to Wabash College and just try to find out what was that like, because I did know that he was run out of there. And it became, among literary figures, kind of, that's what happens when you go to a place like Indiana. And I wanted to know the story. Well, as it turns out, Wabash College had an incredible archive of stuff relating to that incident. And there had been a brilliant young undergraduate, a sophomore, as I recall, in the 50s, who was able to contact all of these now elderly men who had been there when Ezra Pound was a faculty member. And a lot of them wrote back to him, and there was this trove of material. It was an incredibly juicy story about why he got fired. And then from there, he went to Europe with the money, with his severance pay, and went with Yeats and founded Modern Literature. It goes directly from Wabash College, his severance pay, to the founding of Modern Literature.
You could live anywhere doing what you do, but you choose to live here, specifically Bloomington. Well, why is that?
Well, it's a university town, and so I have access to one of the best research libraries in the world. I also have access to all these brilliant people where I go off into a new subject and I'm trying to get traction. Pretty much, I can find somebody on the IU faculty who can give me a primer on what it is that I'm now supposed to try to understand. And that's a rare thing. I'm also 50 minutes from an international airport, and it's great to live in a university town. It's, you know, you have lots going on all the time, and it's a lively place.
Doug Wissing. His new book is called In Writing, Uncovering the Unexpected Hoosier State. We talked on the terrace at the Indiana Historical Society, which has published the book along with Indiana University Press. Up next, how Doug Wissing ended up in Afghanistan several times and the surprising results of those trips.
Our aspirations, wrapped up in books, our inclinations, hidden in books.
This is Indiana Weekend with John Strauss on Indiana Public Radio.
People must ask you all the time where you get your ideas. Do you keep a file? Are you a clipper, or do you save stuff that you read online, or do you have a long list of things you'd like to do?
Probably yes to all your questions. As we talked about earlier, I have spent the last 5 or 6 years covering our failed counterinsurgency in Afghanistan, our failed war in Afghanistan, and that came from me being in Mexico, and I happened to pick up a Herald Tribune, an international Herald Tribune. I was standing on a street corner in Mexico, and I read this article about a team of farmer soldiers in Afghanistan who had this idea of doing a wheat seed farm, 8,000-acre wheat seed farm at 11,000 feet. Well, I've done a lot of work in Tibet, and I'm standing there going, you can't grow wheat at 11,000 feet. It was a bunch of Texans, and they were going to airlift in Great Plains-sized grain harvesters into this incredibly remote area. I've spent a lot of time in Central Asia. These people make $2 a day. Illiteracy is about 80-some, 90%. As it turns out, it was about 10% there. So it's not exactly like you can leave an instruction book for the harvester. It made no sense at all. And I'm reading this article there in Mexico, and I see down there, oh, there's going to be an Indiana team of farmer soldiers. I thought, my goodness, I've seen failed development all over the world. These guys, the Texans, are nuts. And I ripped it out and stuck it in my briefcase. About a month later, I found that. And I went, oh, yeah, the Hoosiers. And I had a little bit of time. I started calling around trying to find this team of Hoosiers. I finally found somebody over at Camp Atterbury, and they said, well, if you want to talk to them, you better come over this afternoon or tomorrow, because they're going to Afghanistan. So I had some time the next morning. I drove over there. I'm Mr. Smug. I'm thinking it's going to be another bunch of people who are going to do a really bad thing. And I sat down with an enormous, like a very large group of officers. And I'm the agribusiness development teams are only 65 people. And I'm sitting there looking at all these officers thinking, this does not make sense. Why are there so many officers? Well, then I found out this was an elite team, and they had handpicked all of these people to do this specific thing. And I was like, okay. And I was thinking they didn't have a clue what they were doing. I said, well, what kind of preparations have you had? Well, they told me they had come to Indiana University and they had studied Pashto. And the commander, a great guy by the name of Brian Copes, he was doing pretty good with Pashto. And they had taken cultural understanding courses because Indiana University has an amazing Central Asian department. They kind of knew a fair amount. I was like, huh. And then they went on to tell me they'd gone to Purdue, where Purdue's got an Afghan agriculture program. And they had learned a lot about Afghan-specific agriculture. And I'm getting like, this is, huh. And I finally came up with my great question. What are the projects that you're going to do? And they said, well, we don't know. We thought we would wait till we got to Afghanistan and ask the Afghans. And I said, well, I'll go with you. And that's how I got to Afghanistan.
How long were you there?
Well, I've been back and forth three times. I've done a fair amount of reporting. I wrote one book called Funding the Enemy, How U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban, about our incredibly chaotic and dysfunctional counterinsurgency. That it's essentially we're waging a privatized, corporatized war that has failed miserably. I went back for my third visit. By this point, that book had had a fairly big impact within policymakers. People began to understand this wasn't working. But yet, our soldiers are still there. They're still waging war. And everybody kind of understands we've lost the war. So I went back to travel back through the war zones. I was back in eastern Afghanistan. I traveled through essentially the war zones of Afghanistan. Helmand and Kandahar, Host, up around Bagram, and in Kabul, and because I wanted to understand what was going on. So I have a new book coming out in the fall that is called Hopeless But Optimistic, Journeying Through America's Endless War in Afghanistan. And it's about how things go on, that even though we're losing, even though we've wasted essentially $1 trillion of taxpayers' money and failed at virtually every one of our military and diplomatic goals. And we need to try and learn from that before we do the same thing.
I'm thinking of James Fallow's book, Blind in the Baghdad, about Iraq, but just this idea that we were so sure of ourselves, and planners starting from the top, disregarding lots of wisdom out there about how to do this. Is that what you're seeing as well?
Yeah, the narrative that is told from rostrums in Washington and in Kabul bear no resemblance to the ground reality. And soldiers essentially told me this. When we'd be out in armored vehicles in Taliban country, and they'd be saying, we're funding both sides of this war. The corruption is so endemic and so systemic, and it runs into every part of this society. We're dumping all of this money. We have spent more money on development and aid in Afghanistan, which is a country of only about 30 million people with a per capita income of about $400 a year. We have spent more money in Afghanistan on aid and development than we spent on the entire Marshall Plan adjusted for inflation. Yet, Afghanistan remains at virtually the bottom of every development indices. Life expectancy, electricity, infant deaths, whatever you want. Education levels, literacy. After $1 trillion of wasted U.S. money, $150 billion of aid, we failed. And the Afghans never got the advantage of that, and they understand it. It all got appropriated.
Does the title of your book mention optimism? Is there room for hope here?
You know, I after going through the war zone, traveling from province to province, hitchhiking rides on helicopters, and you know, it's rough out there. The soldiers, while we're talking about a terrible dysfunction at the top and on a strategic level, there's just enormous courage by the people on the ground. It's amazing how they persist. They do their job. They do the best they can. It's really inspiring. But I, by the time I got through that, I'd seen the pain. I'd seen people, what this is doing, not just to us, but to the Afghan society. I got back to Kabul, back to the capital, and I thought it was hopeless. But I decided once I was there, and Kabul is under siege, essentially. There are attacks all the time. There's kidnappings all the time. It is a capital under siege. I would get in a little white taxi, and I was determined to find things that had sustained for a long time, that had done good, that were Afghan appropriate. And I found them. There's something called the Dutch Committee for Afghanistan. They have been there maybe going back to when the king was still there. They've been through the king, the Soviet era, the Mujahideen, the Taliban era, now our era. They just keep doing this one very specific thing. They train Afghan tribesmen to be paravets. It's a farming society. And all they do is they go to the tribal elders and they say, do you have someone that you would like to have trained to be a paravet to help with your herds? And the Afghans understand the value of this. They say, sure, and they find somebody that they think would be smart. The Dutch take him away and train them with very basic things. And they provide them with access to good vaccines and good medicine, because there's lots and lots of terrible counterfeit stuff around. They help them get started at a very basic level. So it's on the Afghan tribal level.
Doug Wissing talking about his reporting from Afghanistan and a book due out later this year. But available now, and just in time for this Indiana bicentennial year, his collection of stories and essays called In Writing, Uncovering the Unexpected Hoosier State. These collections are always fun. A couple other favorites of mine are Indiana and Interpretation by John Bartlow Martin and The Indiana Way, A State History by James H. Madison. How about you? Do you have a good Hoosier story to share? Drop me a note at indianaweekend@gmail.com. That's our show for today. I'm John Strauss. Big thanks to our producer, Sean Ashcraft, and all the folks in the front office, including your friends Matt Bloom, Connie Clary, Lori Georgie, Emily Kowalski, Andrea Lutz, John Morgan, Angie Rapp, and Debbie Webb. Glad you could join us this time. Hope you'll stay in touch. Drop me a note at indianaweekend@gmail.com if you would like more information or have a suggestion. In the meantime, thanks and have a great week. Until we meet again on the next Indiana Weekend on Indiana Public Radio.
Indiana Weekend with host John Strauss. Our show is engineered at Indiana Public Radio, produced by Sean Ashcraft. Major support for Indiana Weekend comes from IPR's listeners. We hope you'll join your friends who are IPR members. You can go to indianapublicradio.org or give us a call at 1-800-646-1812. Join us again next week for Indiana Weekend with John Strauss here on Indiana Public Radio.